Dolly Parton. The country singer made a cameo appearance in one of Craig's recent sermons. I would have liked, though, to hear Craig in his British accent sing a couple verses of 9 to 5. But that didn't happen. Perhaps we can ask him at the coffee hour. So today I'm going to pull in one of Dolly's contemporaries, the late Johnny Cash, the man in black. I remember that in Craig's sermon that Craig, who can sing, didn't, so I, who cannot, will. And you will help me. I keep a close watch on this heart of mine. I keep my eyes wide open all the time. I keep the ends out for the tie that binds, because you're mine.
I walk the line.
Yeah, better than 8 o'clock. I Walk the Line was written in 1956 after Johnny married the love of his life, she of country music royalty, June Carter Cash. The song explains that Johnny, who had been arrested numerous times, was committing to a new life because his respect and love for June from then on would be the bottom line. What are the voices of authority in your life? Where would you draw the line that you would not cross for moral or ethical reasons? Is this line where it is because of what you learned in your family, like your mother telling you not to lie? Or in church, where you learned about the Good Samaritan, or from something that happened to you, or because of something you witnessed, like someone being bullied, or did it have to do with race or gender? Or is it simply your conscience? Would you draw the line at murdering another human being, killing an innocent animal, lying to your family, stealing from your employer, not crossing a picket line? I have a routine appointment at Health Partners in 2 weeks, right when an 8-day nurses' strike is planned. Personally, I cannot cross a picket line. I've been a worker for too long and know the futility and desperation that puts people on the sidewalk in the cold, walking in circles, carrying a sign. The greatest contemporary scholar of world religions, Houston Smith, said that the essence of morality is drawing the line somewhere. Today's lessons point to one Judeo-Christian reference point, the Ten Commandments. The reading from Deuteronomy reminds us to obey the commandments and in so doing, to choose life. The psalm says that the commandments are a gift to help us live a better life. And in the gospel, Jesus turns up the heat and intensifies the demands of 4 of the commandments. Note that Jesus does not replace the commandments. He was an observant Jew who treasured his scriptures, but like all rabbis to this day, debated and discussed what they really meant. As a young Lutheran, I was taught that the Old Testament, more respectfully called the Jewish scriptures, were the law, while the New Testament, or the Christian scriptures, were the gospel, and that the good news superseded the law. This is completely inconsistent with what Jesus really says. He interprets. He doesn't replace. He remained an observant Jew to his death. Now, most of us don't really like being told what to do. We think of exceptions and qualifications. I've always liked the phrase children used to use, "You're not the boss of me." I really like that. The Franciscan Richard Rohr points out, though, that the opposite of faith is not doubt. The opposite of faith is control. Acquiescing to a moral code is giving up a certain degree of control. For most of us, our instinct is to hear the commandment as God laying down the law, literally, on stone tablets, with a thunderous, threatening voice as Charlton Heston playing Moses hears in the movie The Ten Commandments, "Thou shalt not," cue lightning. But what if we heard the commandments in a different way, in a soft, loving voice, as a cautionary tale instead of admonitions carved in stone? What if we heard it as a loving parent might say them to us, as Mr. Rogers might advise us? Do not steal. You hate that when someone does that to you. Don't lie to anyone. Do not treat poor people differently than you treat rich people. That isn't fair, is it? You shouldn't try to get back at people. That doesn't work. Do not kill. Please. It is logical as well as loving for God to offer us the gift of these commandments. It is what a caring parent would do, and at some level, we are hungry for them. Let me also mention that all of the world's major religions agree on a common moral code, especially about killing and about compassion. In today's gospel, then, Jesus intensifies the demands of four commandments involving murder, adultery, divorce, and lying. And he puts the emphasis on how each of these affects not only obedience to God, but human relationships. So not only an anachronistic screed about being good or the name of a bad old movie, the Ten Commandments, as Jesus elaborates on them in this gospel, show us that relationships are where most of our moral choices are made, and the ancient trustworthy tradition of the commandments can help us do relationships right. First, the commandment not to murder. Well, first we have to mention that our culture, our government, sanctions selective murder, as in war, and in some states, capital punishment. But Jesus says that murder is not only taking someone's life, it is also demeaning them by taking their dignity and their humanity through anger, insults, name-calling. Since many of us are prone to some of this behavior on occasion, we are called to stop it and then reconcile with those we have hurt. Secondly, it is not only the act of adultery that is prohibited, but also lust, which means unchecked sexual desire. I looked it up because I really wasn't sure. You're all thinking Jimmy Carter right now, but I'm going to top that with a quotation from Anglican C.S. Lewis, who once parodied this voice, saying, "He that but looketh on a plate of ham and eggs to lust after it hath already committed breakfast with it in his heart." Perhaps Jesus calls us to remove as many sources of temptation from our lives as we can, especially in our sex-saturated culture, a tall order, and also to look critically at the workplace or at our neighborhoods and social circles for the flirtations, the friendships, the innocent exchanges that eventually can threaten our primary relationship. Young people face particular challenges. The Journal of the American Academy of Pediatricians reports that more than 75% of primetime television programming contains sexual content, yet only 14% of sexual incidents mention any risks or responsibilities of sexual activity. Between 1997 and 2005 alone, the amount of sexual content on TV doubled. And an analysis of the 279 most popular songs in 2005, which I could not name any, revealed that 37% contained sexual references and that degrading sexual references were common. Third, divorce. The preacher David Lose writes this: "The laws about divorce in the Old Testament are patriarchal, pure and simple. A man could divorce his wife by simply writing on a piece of paper, 'I divorce you.'" Lose goes on, "The woman had no options. She can't remarry. She has no more dowry. She's consigned to a life of poverty, depending on the kindness of her family, who is not at all obligated to take her in again. When Jesus talks of divorce, this is the kind of divorce he knows about. And so he defends the woman who is powerless and says, 'No divorce, except for unchastity,' which I'll get to in a minute. Over the years, others have used this passage to say that no matter what, Jesus forbids divorce. But men and women in abusive relationships are not meant to be together. It is unfaithful, unchaste, for a man or woman to verbally or physically abuse one another." Lose, himself a pastor, says, "I have rejoiced at times when a partner has had the courage to ask for a divorce." Fourth, lying has become situational, conditional today. We lie to save someone's feelings, to prevent a greater wrong, or to be funny. Gotcha, I was just kidding. Yet Jesus says that our words are to be not humorless, but honest, truthful, consistent. We are to be people of our word. Collectively, what are the implications of these words of Jesus today? What are the consequences when our most visible celebrities and highest leaders model immorality, deception, name-calling, and insults against other human beings as a matter of course? These questions may seem like fiercely polarizing ones, but they are important questions, and it is appropriate and necessary to address them in this place. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, the German Lutheran theologian and martyr at the hands of Hitler, wrote, "But with a yes to God comes just as clearly a no. Your yes to God requires your no to all injustice, all evil, all lies, all oppression, and violation of the weak and poor. No to all ungodliness and to all mockery of what is holy. Belief means decision." I'm puzzled, frankly, by Christian evangelicals, some of them, who say that moral failings in our leadership are less important than the correct political agenda, and are willing to look the way when every single commandment, parallel to the moral basis of all the world's great religions, are violated. It's not the first time. The mighty Roman Empire that ruled the world for over 500 years is gone. One reason being a series of increasingly corrupt leaders. Listen to what Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, the chief rabbi of Great Britain, writes. "How probable is it that a tiny people, the children of Israel, known as the Jews, numbering less than a fifth of 1% of the population of the world, would outlive the empire that sought its destruction? Or that a small persecuted sect known as Christians would one day become the largest movement of any kind in the world?" He goes on, "There have been many superpowers. Spain in the 15th century, Venice in the 16th, Holland in the 17th, France in the 18th, Britain in the 19th, the United States in the 20th. Yet Judaism has existed for some form for the better part of 4,000 years, Christianity for 2,000, and Islam for 14 centuries. Religions survive. Superpowers have not. Spiritual systems have the capacity to defeat the law of decline that overruns the life of nations." Sacks concludes, "Awareness of the fragility and impermanence of our world should penetrate the cocoon of denial we have so carefully woven." Now, on an individual level, however, how do we construct a framework for moral decency in our particular culture? What propels us to do the right thing towards our neighbors, God, and even ourselves, to live the faith to which we are called? When I take a sip of water, the same thing happens that used to happen at Blake when I would stop to correct an AV problem, and all the commotion in the class would stop and stare at me while I was fixing the projector. Just a thought. Jesus taught that all the commandments are based on a single idea. Frederick Buechner explained it this way: loving God with all our hearts, minds, and souls, and our neighbors as ourselves, is the basis for judging all other commandments and laws. Lesser laws are to be obeyed only if they are consistent with the law of love, and superseded if they're not. So Jesus said, for example, that healing on the Sabbath, even though it was work, was permissible because love and compassion demanded it. He goes on to say that loving your neighbor isn't primarily a feeling. Instead, it means acting in their best interest no matter what, even if personally you can't stand them. There is only your heart to go by here, and whatever by God's grace it has picked up in the way along the way. This kind of action often begins internally within our very souls and the conflicting feelings we have about our lives. The writer David Brooks observed that moral empowerment often occurs most reliably when the heart is warmed. How does this happen? I endured my share of difficulties as a young person and later, and now I have two figurines in my living room that are from my parents' house on Curtis Street. Two small Elizabethan figures, she with an apron full of flowers, he scanning the horizon. Sexism, anyone? Oh, I'll take care of my little flowers. You go find the world. Since these were my parents' wedding gifts, they were there before I was, and they have witnessed much of my life. I can still see them on the bookcase shelf where they stood near the front door. Now I see them, though, in the context of words from Bishop Cheban Charleston, who calls up this image. We all bear the soul scars of a wrong done to us. Feel the warm hand of one who was there and loves you all the more for what you've endured. Sometimes it is the Creator that warms our heart, other times it's other people. As one person put it, you can steel your heart against any kind of trouble, any kind of horror, but the simple act of kindness from a stranger will unstitch you. When someone I don't know extends a hand to me on the ice, or a mysterious stranger in the car ahead of me pays for my lunch at a drive-through, I'm warmed by that action the whole day. And I feel the same way if I'm the one extending the hand. So with hearts warmed by love received and love bestowed even in the smallest kindnesses, we move forward individually and collectively. So I want to close with three things from a book that I just read by John Meacham called The Soul of America. The first one was on the blog that I wrote Friday, Epistles and Epiphanies, and I'm realizing that no one I talked to yet has read it, so I'm going to repeat it. It talks about the day that Lee surrendered to Grant at Appomattox Courthouse in Virginia. And what happened was that Grant made sure no one else was in the room. It would just be the two of him. He had sent words out to the troops, do not gloat. The rebels are our countrymen again. And when Lee came in, Grant was dignified and specific, Lee subdued and respectful. When they left, Lee got on his horse and left, and as he left, Grant saluted, and Lee tipped his hat out of respect. This is an image that feeds me in terms of its civility and its decency at the most difficult of times. Secondly, Meacham writes about our country, for all our darker impulses, for all of our shortcomings, and for all of our dreams denied and deferred, the experiment begun so long ago, carried out so imperfectly, is worth the fight. There is, in fact, no struggle more important and none nobler than the one we wage in the service of those better angels who, however besieged, are always ready for battle. And finally, this is a more personal statement by Congressman John Lewis that Meacham cites, who was nearly beaten to death at the foot of the Edmund Pettus Bridge in Selma, Alabama, on Bloody Sunday, March 7, 1965, in a protest for voting rights. Lewis said this, "At the moment when I was hit on the bridge and started to fall, I really thought it was my last protest, my last march. I thought I saw death, and I thought, it's okay, it's all right. I'm doing what I'm supposed to do." And that is the bottom line.